Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Welcome, my wonderful, wonderful audience. This should be a spectacular 60 minutes, or I have failed, because my guest is Peter Goetze. Peter is one of the world's leading critics of psychiatry. He's many other things, and was many other things long before he became one of the world's leading critics of psychiatry. He founded the Corcoran Group. Corcoran was the supposed to be, and he really led it in that direction, the leading scientific imprimatur in the world. Articles published under the Corcoran name were supposed to have real scientific validity to them. And as all things deteriorate over time under the onslaught of the pharmaceutical industry and medical establishment, Peter was no longer welcome a few years ago in his own organization. And you can learn about that actually on our website, Bregan.com, and on Peter's website. What's the name of your website, Peter?
I have two websites. One is called deadlymedicinesinoneword.dk. DK means Denmark. And the other one is called scientificfreedom.com. In one word, .dk.
And Peter has written amazing books. Deadly Medicine is incredible insight into what goes wrong in the pharmaceutical medical complex. I've started calling it the pharmaceutical empire. It's such a giant problem. And then he wrote Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial. Did I get that title right?
Yes, 5 years ago.
Amazing book. It is a book up there, I feel, with my books. And I think at 84, I can be proud now of the tradition I hoped to establish of great critique of psychiatry and trying to transform it. And certainly Peter Goetze's book was just profound and profoundly disturbing to psychiatry. I think it also contributed to your running into problems at your own organization, Corcoran. And eventually, Peter was released from Corcoran, let go of. And he took a new direction, an independent direction, with his own Institute for Scientific Freedom. He continues to do his scientific work in a variety of fields. I'm very proud to be friends and colleagues with him. And being as you're a bit younger than me, I'm really glad you're out there working in this area, being really critical of psychiatry. I think we both agree that there's more wrong with psychiatry than right. And perhaps we could even begin with that right now. So Peter Goetze, I want to unleash you to just begin with some of your thoughts on where is psychiatry right now? What do we need to do about it?
Well, it's a total disaster. And it is a disaster because the psychiatrists believe so much in their drugs. And they don't realize that all psychiatric drugs are harmful in the long run. And people who get on them usually take them for many years. I have just published a study that shows that people on depression pills and neuroleptics, also called antipsychotics, they generally take them for many years. They just go on and on and on, which increases the risk of permanent brain damage. And this is actually why I have written another book about psychiatry that I published just 2 weeks ago, which is called Mental Health Survival Kit and Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. So let's take the last bit first. More than 100 million people in this world, likely more than 200 million people, have become dependent on psychiatric drugs, that they cannot get off them. Because if they try themselves, or if they ask their doctor to help them, the advice is that they should do it far too quickly. And then they develop withdrawal symptoms, also called abstinence symptoms, because their brain has got used to these drugs. And then they are typically put back on the full dose and told they need to go on for years or perhaps for the rest of their lives. So people don't know how to taper off psychiatric drugs safely. And I have learned a lot from your work and your recent book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and also from other people and other books and articles. So I have written a guide how this could be done in my new book. And people have welcomed the book so much that volunteers have told me they want to translate it into their language for free, at no cost for me, even into small languages like Icelandic and Greek. And it will also appear in Swedish and Dutch, which are also small languages. So it seems to fill a need.
That's wonderful, by the way, Peter. That's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm very pleased about that. And I would also like to tell you a little about the resistance I have met when I tried to arrange courses on psychiatric drug withdrawal in Denmark. 3 years ago, I wanted to arrange a full-day course in Copenhagen, and I contacted the Danish charity called MIND, which is the biggest patient organization in psychiatry in Denmark. And I asked them if they wanted to write about the course in their member journal, because it was relevant for more than 100,000 Danish patients, and also for the psychiatrists who don't know how to do it, to withdraw safely. And the response was that, no, I'm not going to get into this debate about psychiatric drugs. And then I said, you don't need to. Many people want to get off these drugs. I want to help them. You don't need to have an opinion about these drugs. No, but they couldn't write about it. And then I said, okay, then I can pay for an advertisement in your member journal. And then I was put on ice. I could get no more contact with MIND's head office. They didn't respond to my phone calls. It was totally silent. So they wanted to sabotage my advertisement, which was going to be helpful for a lot of people, including psychiatrists. So then I teamed up with a television crew and we went to the headquarters. This is what they call gate crashing. And the director of MIND became furious. And I have described the whole incident in my book. But since there was now television on it, then after 2 days, I was told that I could have the advertisement. That was very close to the deadline. So, but it's amazing. The chair of MIND in Denmark is positive to psychiatric drugs, and he just has too much power over his organization, like we see it in so many organizations. So that's just one example. Another example is that a psychiatrist wanted to have a two-hour seminar at the annual meeting for Danish psychiatrists. And he wanted me to lecture at his seminar, which was mostly about withdrawal of sleeping pills, benzodiazepines. And then the Danish Psychiatric Association responded that they didn't have time in the program. And then I thought, what can be more important than having a seminar about how to stop these drugs? So then I called the hotel and they said there was a room left. So I decided to have a seminar both in the morning and repeating it in the afternoon for the psychiatrists during their annual meeting. And that was actually very interesting, because after these seminars, I was told by a young psychiatrist we met in the corridors that they had been direly warned by their bosses to attend any of my seminars that would not be looked upon kindly back at the department. So, you know, it's not science, it's a total religion, and they don't even want to help people get off psychiatric drugs and actively try to sabotage when others take the initiative they should have taken decades ago. What do you think about that, Peter?
Well, of course, I have an infinite number of similar experiences over the years. It is hard to explain how a profession could become so corrupt. But I think psychiatry is just totally, thoroughly corrupt now. And, you know, I've written about how psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins. It doesn't take a lot of connecting of dots to realize they're poisonous to brain cells, and their basic way of impacting on the brain is to harm the cells and the neurotransmitter systems and the overall functioning with the first dose. And it's just a relative amount as to dosage and idiosyncratic reactions. And over time, what happens to the patients, as you know, is they develop the inability to understand how much they've been harmed.
Yes.
I call that intoxication anosognosia, or medication spellbinding. So they have locked in, like slaves, patients who do not know that they are losing their faculties over the years. Their loved ones may notice, friends may notice, but none of their doctors will notice. And they will attribute it, it's just like the electroshock doctors, they attribute all the adverse effects to mental illness or age or something else, rather than to the inevitable harm to the brain of taking any very strong psychoactive substances for years and years and years. I mean, we know it from alcohol, we know it from marijuana, anything that's impacting grossly on your brain over years, not good for it. But psych drugs are particularly bad because they are tailored to be bad. Yeah. The way they're discovered, I mean, people don't know it. The way they're discovered is first you find a drug that disrupts the normal functioning of a rat brain that goes through the blood-brain barrier, floods the brain, goes throughout the brain, changes neurotransmitter systems. And then you say, well, that's a potential psychiatric drug. And in fact, if it disrupts the serotonin system, our FDA is likely to think, well, it's good for phase one. We'll start studying it. It's disrupting serotonin. That's what Prozac does and all the other antidepressants. Or if it's disrupting and blocking dopamine, they'll say, well, that's a potential antipsychotic drug. So folks, the way the selection process is to find neurotoxins, drugs that harm the system. But the corruption is, it's always been hard for me to grasp. But folks, you're talking to the only two physicians that I know of who've written books on how to withdraw from psychiatric drugs. And how is that? Why is that?
Well, it's too threatening for the psychiatrist if the patients find out that there is a better life being drug-free than being taking psychiatric drugs for many, many years. if the psychiatrist didn't prescribe so many psychiatric drugs, but focused on psychotherapy and other social psychological interventions, then they would have to compete with psychologists and other therapists. So it's threatening to them. And I can give you another example of institutional corruption. My former own organization, Cochrane, that 3 years ago, I talked to the editor of the Cochrane Depression Group that I wanted to do a Cochrane review on withdrawal of depression pills. And she told me that sounded a very good idea. And then I hired a psychologist to work with me. And when we submitted a protocol to the Cochrane Depression Group, we didn't hear anything for a long, long, long time.
God.
And the month went by and it developed and we submitted revisions of the protocol depending on the editor's comments and other people's comments. And the demands to our protocol increased all the time and they became totally absurd. One editor wanted us to actually praise depression pills in our background section and telling people how wonderful these drugs were for a lot of ailments. And our review was about people who wanted to get off them. So they weren't so happy about these pills. So why should we praise them? It was like an advertisement for Eli Lilly or Lundbeck that Cochrane wanted us to insert. And then they wanted us to explain which types of depression pills do you want to include in your review? And we responded, all of them, everyone. What type of patients, what disorders? And we said, all of them. We don't care whether they have depression, anxiety, whatever they have. If they want to come off their drug, they will experience similar difficulties, no matter what their condition is, no matter what their pill is. And we struggled and struggled and struggled with them. And then they suddenly, after having open peer review, they suddenly took an eighth peer reviewer who was now anonymous, who produced one of the worst peer reviews I've seen in my whole life, where that person subscribed to the lie about that you are ill because you have a chemical imbalance and all the rest of the lies in psychiatry. And he wanted us to be, or she, I don't know the gender, wanted us to comply with all these absurd demands. So the hangman was anonymous. Everyone else were not. And then our review was suddenly rejected, our protocol for the review. So I then complied with all the absurd demands from the hangman, and then we submitted yet another version of our protocol, and we appealed to the editor, and then we appealed to another one, and then we appealed the third time to the editor-in-chief in Cochrane, who unfortunately, guess what, is a psychiatrist. So the protocol was turned down, but I wrote about this scandal on the Mad in America website, and it's also in my book. My new book. It's a total scandal that Cochrane, which I helped found in 1993. We wanted to help patients. Cochrane Depression Group doesn't want to help patients come off their drug. This is an enormous scandal. But of course, we will publish our review elsewhere.
Folks, it can't be exaggerated, the extent of the suppression of people who speak against psychiatry. Peter Goetze, whom we're talking with, is an internist by training. And I think it was just later on that you got around to looking at the scientific literature of psychiatry. And you hadn't even read my stuff. You just looked at it and said, this is garbage.
I had seen a lot, Peter, before I came to psychiatry. But I was flabbergasted. I had never seen anything so poor as psychiatric science. It was horrible.
Well, I think it has no science, so it lives by violence, violence against patients. It forces patients, and I think a little later we'll get to talk about your latest study on involuntary treatment and appeals to it in Denmark, which sound exactly like what happens in my experience in Canada and the United States. I wanted to add to the idea of why psychiatrists and general physicians, by the way, the reason we emphasize psychiatrists, folks, is not because they give most of the drugs. Most of you out there, you've gotten your medications from pediatricians, internists, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, because psychiatrists are a small part of the dispensing arm of the drug industry, which is what they are. They're part of the dispensing arm. A second reason the psychiatrists don't want the patients to come off their drugs is not just that they'll learn they can do without them, but they'll learn how injured they are. When you're on the drugs, you just don't get it. And this is so important for everybody out there to understand, is why I'm bringing it up a second time, that there's something about the brain and mind that it just doesn't grasp traumatic injury. If you look at the traumatic brain injury literature, one of the things you learn is that it's one of the great problems with rehab is patients just don't grasp how injured they are. They're in denial. It seems to be a human defense mechanism psychologically, but I think even more, it's when you injure the frontal lobes, you lose self-insight, you lose the ability to be aware of yourself. Yeah. And so you go to the easiest default position, which is I'm fine.
Yeah.
And I've had allergies and all my life, and I used to take Benadryl at night. And I would get up in the morning after a dose of Benadryl, and I would find something to complain about my wife. Only I love my wife, Ginger. So it was a little odd to me, but I didn't think it was anything. And about the third time, she said, honey, this is Benadryl. You wake up in the morning after Benadryl, you're irritable with me. And I had to really look at it because I wanted to be rational, and my irritability was based on something she must have done, even if I couldn't identify it. And this is what happens to people who have head injuries, who have electroshock, who have lobotomies even more so, and who are on any kind of psychoactive potent substances enough over the years to get harmed. The harms, folks, are beyond imagination now. With the antipsychotic drugs, which are now being sold and marketed as antidepressants, like Abilify and Seroquel, and they're looked upon as adjuvants or helpers to give you along with your antidepressant. They just flatten more of your emotions. These drugs are shortening lifespan by a decade or two.
Terribly much.
Yeah, I mean, it's just awful, and they do it from multiple causes. Yeah. And we also have more studies. The British psychiatrists are taking this seriously. I first wrote about this in the 1980s in the scientific literature. Be harder to get something published now, I think. They cause atrophy of the brain.
Yeah.
And basically, every category of drug that we've looked at, we have studies showing physically measurable harm to the brain over time. The stimulants for children, the antidepressants, all the categories of psych drugs. So we're looking at a catastrophe, and that's one of the reasons that psychiatry has to sit with such a tight lid on all of this. They've got to just do what they're doing while clamping down on anybody learning about it in reality, understanding just how bad these drugs are for people. And they don't really help. I know that a lot of people feel helped by the drugs, not as many as you might think if you try to find them. Most people just are confused because, as you've pointed out, they get upset when they come off the drugs and they think it's their problem and they don't realize it's a physiological withdrawal reaction.
Yeah.
But people also, when they're in trouble, anything that takes the edge off your emotion feels better. It's why people smoke marijuana. It's why people drink.
Yeah.
It's all the drugs. And eventually even the stimulants end up flattening your emotions. But
you can turn it around, Peter, and then tell what people tell us who have come off their drugs.
Yes.
These emails I get from people where they say, I read your book and I decided to get off my depression pill. And then one day I suddenly heard the birds singing in the forest. And of course they had been singing every year, but she hadn't noticed it.
Perfect. Yeah.
Just one example. And of course, as you know, people also say, well, sometimes they say, yeah, well, it can be tough when your emotions come back.
Yes.
Because it's both positive and negative emotions, but it's more like me. It's more like a real life.
Yes. They can relate again. They can engage again.
Yes.
I've had families tell me, a woman who was sitting with her husband and he said that the medication had helped him. She was the motivation behind coming in.
Yeah.
And she said, and he looked kind of flat to me. And she said, honey, you don't even care about the dog anymore. He used to come home and he would greet you and you would hug him. And now you brush him away the way you brush me away. And he said something like, it's not as bad as it was or something like that. And actually he did come off his medications and he was very, very, very grateful for it. The effect can happen so quickly, Peter. I had a very intelligent patient who'd only been on the drugs, on Zoloft, for 2 weeks. And he'd gone on it because it looked like he was going to lose his job. At least he thought he was. And after he went on the Zoloft, he was convinced he was going to lose his job. And I did an inventory with him about, well, what's going on in your life? He didn't have friends. There weren't a lot of things he was interested in. And so on. And I actually believed him. I had no reason to think that his life wasn't bleak. He was a bachelor. And I said, well, let's get you off these meds and you want to get off them. And I said, it's going to be real easy. You've only been taking them for 2 weeks. I think you could have it for a day or two and stop. And this, folks, is only for somebody who's on no other meds. He's really healthy.
Yeah.
He's only been on them 2 weeks. Why prolong the withdrawal to 4 weeks? And I said, come back next week, stay in touch with me. Here's my cell phone. You know, I really pay a lot of attention. He comes back in 2 weeks. He's bright. He's happy. He said, I went out with my friends fishing yesterday. I said, I didn't know you had friends. You didn't mention them to me.
Yeah.
He said, really? Really? See, this is what the drugs do. They just take you away from yourself.
Yeah.
He had a rich life that he couldn't even engage enough to tell me he'd been doing it up to 2 weeks ago for his whole lifetime. Go ahead.
Yeah. let me tell you another story I just learned about today. I sent my new book to a person who is a patient representative in a psychiatric patient association. And she and her husband read the book very quickly. They had both been on depression pills for more than 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously they believed that they did something good for them. But after having read my book, they immediately, both of them, decided that they should taper off the drugs. And then they asked me how they should do it. I mean, these are just the little things that keep you and me going against all this resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's worth it.
Yeah, the whole reform life is worth it. And you and I have been doing that for a long, long time. You know, folks, people like Peter and I, we do get heavily attacked. Our lives get threatened. They went after my medical license. That was their big deal because I purposely didn't belong to any institutions. I was an entirely independent private practicing psychiatrist, although I had hoped in the beginning to be the youngest president of the American Psychiatric Association. And instead, I became a man with a target on his back that they were shooting at. But I had private practice, and so they had a great, other than threatening my life and the other kinds of things that go on that are even worse than that, they didn't have an institutional hook on me, and so they went after my medical license. And when we won that, and we got coverage on that because it was on a freedom of speech issue, they went after my medical license on my criticism of drugs on Oprah Winfrey. It was the wrong thing. It was like God's hand. It was the wrong thing to do. First of all, I've been on Oprah a few times. She loved me. We got along really well. And she just backed me 100%. And this is a funny story, Peter. The Psychiatric Association had never run into this before, a really critical show on psychiatry that I'd done with Oprah and four or five psychiatric survivors.
Yeah.
None of whom are still alive. Oh, my God. I hadn't thought of that. And they were not older than me. Oh, that is amazing. They invited me on, and Oprah and I talked a little bit in the green room, and she said, what's the matter with psychiatry? And I said, Oprah, they have no heart. My colleagues have no spirit. They don't understand that we're human beings. They think we're machines to be put into lower gear or something. She was aghast at this. So the Psychiatric Association went after her so hard that there was a threat literally to Oprah. And at the time, she was in Chicago, but she was already a national person of importance in the mid-80s. And the producer thought she might lose her job. They were threatening him from up high that she had to have psychiatry come on and have its own show. And she said, I won't. I'll have the president, you bring the president of the Psychiatric Association, whose name was Fink, great name, come and debate Dr. Breggin. And each of you can bring your patient.
Yeah.
So he brought this really depressed person they were funding as the establishment's answer to the psychiatric patient movement. And I brought Judy, and I'm blocking on her name right now, a wonderful woman, not my patient at all. She'd been a patient as a child. And she was now a professor in Boston and the rehabilitation, and she was just a shining light, and we just demolished them. It was like it was crushing blow to them. And that's when they went after my medical license really hard.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But we won, and that was a big event for us. So what I want to say is that this is a hard way of life, but for those of us who do it, I think we're all grateful to have the opportunity. And I know I feel that way.
I would say, being a specialist in internal medicine and having worked a lot with infections and gastroenterology, for example, and rheumatology, I have come to the conclusion that there is nothing more important in medicine than withdrawing as many psychiatric patients as we can from psychiatric drugs. It's probably the biggest disaster we have in healthcare today. I'm convinced that it is the biggest disaster we have, because a lot of people die because of the drugs, and a lot of people are permanently harmed. And in my new book, for example, I have a very sad story about a young man who was put on a depression pill, and his sex drive went away completely.
Yeah.
And his emotional life was killed. And even after he had stopped the drug, his emotions didn't come back. His sex life didn't come back. He finally committed suicide. He was totally normal. And I got the permission from his mother to write his story in my new book. But I have been at psychiatric meetings where whenever I start telling stories, they are just arrogant and say, oh, that's just an anecdote. It's not an anecdote. It's what really happened. And if you look at it statistically, we now know, based on randomized trials, that depression pills double the risk of suicide, not only in children, but also in adults. These pills should not be used by anyone, if you ask me.
Now, I agree with you 100%. They should not be used by anyone.
No. And of course, I cite you very early on in my book, where I write that I have some advice for patients in square brackets. And already 3 pages into the book, I bring your advice. If you have a psychiatric problem, don't look up a psychiatrist. It's too dangerous.
Yeah.
That's kind of the best advice I can give to people. Psychiatry is about psychology. It's not about drugs.
Yes, it is. It's about psychology. It's about spirituality. It's about how to live life. It's about, people ask me, what is the alternative to psychiatric drugs? Life. Life yes. offers many alternatives to psychiatric drugs. Yeah. Maybe your alternative is yoga. Acupuncture.
I have another version, Peter. When I lecture and criticize psychiatric drugs, and the audience ask me, yes, they are perhaps not so good, but what is the alternative? And then I say, easy, no psychiatric drugs.
That's right.
It's far better, far better.
That's right.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that's really to the point. Your point you're making about the psychiatric withdrawal being the biggest problem we're facing in the world today, or rather the plague of neurotoxins inflicted upon people from which we need to help people withdraw. I can't even remember anymore whether I wrote a blog about this or not, or did a video on it, but I've addressed my psychiatric colleagues and said, you could have very good, productive lives, even make an income and save tens of millions of people from brain damage using your medical skills. Take them off the drugs. Learn how to do it. Read my books. Take Peter's courses. Take my courses. We're both doing a very similar things. And make things available. You could be a psychiatrist for the rest of your life and do nothing but take people off psychiatric drugs and help them find good help. And you would change. You'd change the world.
There are two things I would really like to say in this program. One of them is that we got access to confidential files at an authority where patients had complained that they had been forced to take antipsychotic drugs. So we went through 30 consecutive cases, and our paper is now in press. It will be published soon. And we showed that in all 30 cases, the Danish law had been violated. And when we could read bits of the patient's files and the expert reports, we could also see a pattern that the psychiatrist did not respect the patient's wishes and experiences at all. They claimed that these drugs had been beneficial for the patients, whereas not a single patient had the same view. Several patients were really scared of getting killed by these drugs because they knew someone who had been killed, and they begged their psychiatrist not to use them. Some of them had not tolerated them very clearly. One of them developed akathisia, a serious form of restlessness that predisposes to suicide, violence, and murder even. And the psychiatrist who wrote the expert report wrote, this patient has developed akathisia on this drug. And then later on the same page, the patient will continue with this drug. I mean, that person should have withdrawn his license. And this is what happens all the time in psychiatry. But we have now documented it in a paper that will come out before long. And all these things we could see, they are just heartbreaking. And one of the worst things is that according to Danish law, you should treat the patients with force, with the least force you can come up with. And clearly, and the least toxic means, and clearly benzodiazepines for an acutely disturbed patient is less dangerous than an antipsychotic, and they even work faster. This has been shown in a Cochrane review. So, and whenever I have lectured for patients and asked them, what would you prefer next time you became very disturbed and psychotic? An antipsychotic or a benzodiazepine if you need a drug to calm you down? All of them have said a benzodiazepine. None of them get it in Denmark. This is a violation of our law. So this is one of the things I wanted to say, that we have a huge amount of patients who are not even allowed to withdraw safely from their drugs. We must not forget them. The other thing I wanted to tell you, Peter, is that when my psychologist and I decided to help patients in practice who wanted to withdraw from their drugs, we felt that we better submit it as a research project at the Scientific Ethics Committee in Copenhagen in order not to get in trouble from the psychiatrist. So we submitted a protocol, and this turned out to be an absurd farce. For example, the committee said that even though two psychiatrists were involved in our project, the one who was directly responsible for helping the patients needed to be a psychiatrist in order to secure patient safety. And this committee had a psychiatrist in the committee. He came from a hospital where they killed two young people within a few months of each other who dropped dead on the floor, killed by an overdose of an antipsychotic. So these are the kind of people who should guarantee patient safety in our review. We were also told to make a systematic review of the risk of patients committing suicide when we tapered off their drugs. And we were also told to explain how could we know whether the patients could tolerate being tapered off their drugs. We needed to explain that. But as you know, Peter, this is a trial and error process where you move very slowly and you see what symptoms that come up. And if you move too fast, you move even more slowly. So it's a catch-22 situation. You cannot write in the protocol which kind of patients cannot tolerate a withdrawal and which kind can tolerate a withdrawal. So these demands just piled up and up and up. And then I gave up. And then I called a lawyer who was working at the Research Ethics Committee. And then I said, we are helping people. And if we don't call it research, you can't forbid us to help people who turn to us for help. No. And then I said, and then we can write it up afterwards. So this is what we did. And my psychologist has now withdrawn most of his first 30 patients, many of whom have tried desperately to withdraw drugs before, also helped by psychiatrists and other doctors. But he knows how to do it, but he wasn't allowed by the Research Ethics Committee to do it. So there again, you have the absurdity, Peter.
Power, power, power.
It's always about power, yes. don't fool around with the Lord's drugs.
You know, there really isn't anything positive to say about psychiatry now. And Thomas Sasse, whom I knew very, very well, wrote The Myth of Mental Illness decades ago. I purposely went to study with him. Had already reaching the same conclusions. He compared it to slavery, that once you became a patient, you were just not free anymore. You were under the thrall. And if they wanted to, they could always involuntarily treat you. And that's true. You've been studying that and demonstrated that. And I know that from my own experience, that even if you're supposedly voluntary, you're not really voluntary in a hospital. They can always threaten you, force you. So that it's a form of slavery. Many people escape from it. That's a little bit different than real slavery. But a part of the lesson is that it won't change from within. It'll just knuckle down more. It's like it's like if you you see a man who's abusing his children, or a woman who's kind of mistreating their children in public, you take a grave risk if you go up and say something to them, because when they get home, they'll just beat the heck out of the victim.
Yes. But Peter, could I give another view?
Oh, yes.
That I actually feel that there is something positive to say about psychiatry. And this is that I have felt that things have actually changed the last 10 years. They have become better. Not much, but there are some young critical psychiatrists who are thinking very much like you and I do. And for example, there were these two psychiatrists in a city of Denmark that opened a department which they called the Department Without Force. So patients know that force will not be used at that department in the psychiatric ward. And the principle about open dialogue from Lapland in Finland is spreading throughout the world, and people are doing studies, even randomized studies, of the value of not jumping on psychotic patients and saying you immediately need an antipsychotic, but instead teaming up with relatives and friends and family and a psychiatrist perhaps and a psychologist, and then talk to that person as quickly as possible after the psychosis started. So in Lapland, they use antipsychotics far less than, for example, in Stockholm. And after 5 years, far more in Stockholm are on disability pension or out of work compared to Lapland. These results are very, very clear. And this way of thinking that comes back from Lauren Mosher. Yeah, they are spreading. So there is some light in the darkness after all.
Well, I think it's a bit excuse me. I think it's a bit encouraging, and I've been encouraged, and I've written about those things. But if we go back, Lauren Mosher was doing this in the 80s.
Yes.
And he had a marvelous program in California. He was head of the schizophrenia branch, which was not very large at the time, in NIMH. So in that sense, we were way ahead then.
Yes.
Because we actually had Lauren was at NIH. He was also a lifetime a public health official. It's a service. It can be uniformed or non-uniformed. U.S. Public Health Service. I was in it for 2 years at NIH. And I knew Lauren. And Lauren, he got fired from everything they could fire him from.
Yes.
And they shut down the program.
Yes.
And so, and we also, even before Lauren, he drew on R.D. Lang. And Lang had programs in Great Britain, that he developed, and there were wards even in hospitals that were drug-free. But it's all crushed. I think the fundamental problem is that as long as we think of it as psychiatry, as long as the public thinks of it as psychiatry has to treat upset human beings, people have been upset since time began, we didn't have any psychiatry, unhappy human beings. Oh, it freaks out psychiatrists when I talk about, well, you're treating unhappiness and I don't think you know much about it. And serious unhappiness, yeah, severe, can lead to murder and suicide. I think psychiatry's got to get out of the way. I don't know how else major reform will be accomplished, but maybe we can do that. Maybe you'll be doing that.
No, I can't do much, but I try. And I argue in my new book why psychiatry should be disbanded.
Yes.
If you have a house with which is rotten, and here in Denmark...
Oh, God, I love that, Peter.
Here in Denmark, we might call craftsmen from Poland to work on a rotten house. And I have seen this happen in my neighborhood. Then after a while, they have to tear down the house anyway, because if it's rotten, it can't be saved. And this is where psychiatry is. It's a rotten house. And therefore we need to demolish it completely and build a totally new house where people think very differently. Exactly. And abandoned all their foolish ideas about chemical imbalances and all their biased
genetics,
yes, and all their biased studies that are terribly flawed, and start all over again. And then, above all, abandon all laws about forced treatments.
Absolutely. As long as they have force, they really don't have to change. They can always run state mental hospitals and run hospitals on the basis of force.
Yes.
Getting rid of involuntary treatment would go a long way to dismantling much of psychiatry, I think.
Yes, I'm sure.
And getting rid of the threat. I'm involved in a case of a man who committed a terribly violent crime. A very good man, a school teacher, fine man, loved his wife, hurt her very badly, on antidepressants. And he had a history of, in the very recent times only, of getting very disturbed on antidepressants. And he was put in jail for his crime. And Selma Eichlenboom, who's an MD and a PhD and a specialist in the way the liver sometimes fails to be able to break down these drugs, to metabolize the drugs. And he wasn't a good metabolizer of the drugs. And I looked at it clinically and decided that he would not have done this except for the drugs. And we were part of what was going to be a plea for involuntary intoxication, that he didn't do this purposefully. He was psychotic at the time. And he was imprisoned. And in jail, he started to do better right away because they didn't put him on drugs. Then they put him on drugs and they put him on antidepressants again. And now for years, he has been going through horrific, nightmarish psychosis. And also for other things that have happened to him in jail and other factors, but mainly the drugs. And he started to refuse the drugs. He read my report. He read Dr. Eichlenboom's report. And he said, I'm not going to take these drugs. And so they brought recently an action against him in court to force him to take the drugs. Now, usually these are rubber stamped. These people have no problem at all getting a judge to rubber stamp something because there's no power on the other side. But now they had Bregan and Eichlenboom. And Reagan immediately said, well, the prison's incapable of helping him. But he has gone twice, actually, to a state facility, a New York state facility, that took him off the drugs and returned him much better until the prisons put him back on drugs again. So I recommend that he be sent to that facility and be given a chance to do the same thing. and that this whole thing be dropped. Well, they did, I was shocked, send him to the other facility. And he was taking medications there that they recommended. He trusted them. And so they dropped, completely dropped. I think they just want to go any further, the involuntary treatment. And then within a day, he said, well, it's been stopped. I'm not afraid anymore of involuntary treatment. I don't want these drugs. That's his right. So they have now immediately gone back and said, we want to restart that hearing without even having to bring anything again. Let's just continue the hearing, which is illegal, unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And I wrote a background letter for the background for a letter that the lawyer sent, which is a right doesn't exist if it only exists when you're not exercising it and is taken away from you when you exercise it. That is not a right. And I explained a little further the irony of this. And right now we're going to fight this thing. And I have permission from the family to tell this story, permission from the lawyers.
So there you have it again, Peter. I learned it in Alaska, where I was an expert witness for Jim Gottstein. Mm-hmm. That the psychiatrists, they lie routinely in court, and I experienced it myself. And the law doesn't exist. And if there is, I mean, there is a law, but it's getting violated all the time, and the judges don't care. In the rest of society, the judges do care if you violate the law, but here they actually contribute to violating the law.
Peter, we have run right up against 60 minutes. We have been talking for an hour.
Yeah.
Peter Goetze, director of the Institute for Scientific Freedom. It's amazing what you're doing. Thank you for being on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. And I want to have you back really about as often as you want. I really want to have my really great guests, my important guests, back as often as possible. Tell people just quickly where they go to find more about you.
Well, two websites. One is called Scientific Freedom in one word, .dk. The other one, Deadly Medicines in plural, also in one word, .dk. And there they can also find information about my books and how to buy the latest one that I just launched 2 weeks ago.
And it's a good book, folks. It's a very, very good book. Thank you, Peter Goetze.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter.